I've had this problem a few times recently where Zoom just like you open it up and nothing, like literally nothing. And then you have this like awkward, like 10 minutes or so, like of people just looking at each other going, I can't hear you. And you sit there and try and, you know, change the settings, tweak this, tweak that, blah, blah, blah. And then nothing happens. And then, so I was just writing, oh yeah, maybe like double check you've got the latest version, because that's normally been the bit that solved the problem. So I go and check if I've got the latest version and a new version's come out. And apparently I've done that and it seems to have worked. So, hey.
Yeah, I know my laptop is weird with like Zoom and with Teams. If I don't connect my Bluetooth audio before I open the app, then it doesn't like it.
Really?
And so I have to make sure. Teams is the worst.
I've never used Teams. I haven't been suckered into that one yet. And I didn't used to record with Zoom. I used to use this, like, I can't even remember what it was called. It's like basically a web application program. And what it did was it effectively recorded your audio and my audio separately. But it meant, so the audio was recorded like direct on your computer. So like for sound quality, it was pretty good. But the problem with it was that you couldn't see each other. And I really think that if you're having a conversation, it's much nicer to see someone as opposed to just a phone call. And
yeah, agreed.
And also I found that people really like watching the podcast as opposed to listening to them as well, which I didn't expect. It was a pleasant surprise, actually. But how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not as tired as I thought I would be. Pretty tired yesterday, but today is a new day. So yeah, doing all right. How about you?
I'm going through about a million and one life stresses at the moment. So I don't sleep very well. I struggle really badly with anxiety anyway. And yesterday we put the whole film for the whole 107 TDF thing live. So that's a huge weight off my shoulders, but that was very stressful to get that sorted out. And then I think I was quite stressed out about it because, you know, I invested a lot emotionally and physically into that challenge. I was wanted the video to kind of do it justice, but it's in the wild. That seems to have got a good response. And then if I, for example, move my mic slightly, you'll be able to see the other reason why there's a lot of stresses going on.
Oh, yeah. You said you were like kind of moving, looking for a new face.
Kind of moving has turned into definitely moving. And house hunting sucks.
But I haven't had to do that yet. Where are you moving to?
Peak District.
Okay. Big move.
Hopefully, fingers crossed. I found a new place and it's just going through all the paperwork stuff at the moment and watching solicitors go, basically email going, oh, can you pay us X amount for fuck knows? Can you pay us X amount for fuck knows? And I'm just like, oh, would you just like to, like, you know, I don't know, just take everything out of my wallet, which currently is £2.60. So yeah, it's been quite stressful. But I think, I don't know, I think it was a big decision, like moving away from London. I've lived in London for 12 years now. I've lived in Shoreditch for 8 years. So it's a big part of my life. But just want some space. It's very simple. Want space. Yeah, don't need to be in London for work. Being able to basically have the Peak District on my doorstep is quite appealing. I've got friends there. So yeah, it's that is why I have massive eye bags at the moment, because, and apparently about 20 different wrinkles on the top of my forehead, because it's just been a lot of stress with that. But yeah, anyway, enough about all of that kind of crap. There was a couple of reasons why I wanted to talk to you, and I guess, like, you first came on my radar properly some years ago, and it was because of the Velocity Posse stuff. And that feels like a long time ago now.
It's actually not been that long. I think I joined Velocity Posse early 2017. So 3 years ago, and then raced for them through 2017 and 2018.
Yeah. And, you know, that, it was just a, I've been a massive fan of that club, collective. I guess you'd say club, it is a club, isn't it? Of
yeah.
Everything that, that you know, has been going on there. And if people don't know Velocity Posse, they should definitely check out the sort of support in women's cycling, especially in London. It's really, really cool. And the kit is bonkers. And that's also something that I really like. It's just bold and fun, isn't it?
Yeah, really fun, really encouraging. And yeah, it's pretty safe to say, like, I wouldn't have made as much progress in racing in that space of time if I hadn't been part of Velocity Posse. Because, like, when I got into cycling, my intention was always to race track, but I didn't have a track bike. So how that was going to happen, I didn't actually know. But they lent me one. And so it meant I managed to do quite a lot in the almost 2 years I was with them.
How track cycling is like its own magical. I'm fascinated by it. I used to do it a little bit when I was younger, and then I stopped because, to be honest, I wasn't very good. Put it simply, it just doesn't suit me. And I think, like, I've, you know, always like gone and watched like the 6 day races when they've been in London. I've gone out to Ghent to watch them as well. And I remember it was like, I can't remember what year it was, but the track world champs were in London at one point, and I went to quite a lot of them, which is really, really cool. It was when Christina Vogel was still racing, so it's before her accident. So, and she was like top yeah. form. Like, it was pretty amazing to watch, actually. But then, you know, on the same side of London, we've got, I mean, we have Lee Valley, which is an incredible facility, but also Herne Hill, which is equally as incredible facility, which offers probably is better as a facility if you're newer to track cycling, I would hazard a guess. I it's probably better for you to say than me, to be honest.
I didn't actually know that Herne Hill existed. So I knew about Lee Valley because, like, it was on, like, the Olympic, like, in the Olympic Park. I'd seen it, like, when it was being constructed. And so I was like, okay, yeah, this is where I can go to do track. And I only found out about Herne Hill once I'd started at Lee Valley, but then it was good to go there and, like, kind of supplement the riding I was doing at Lee Valley. Herne Hill is great because they have, like, weekly women's sessions. And then the first race I did was their women's league. And yeah, even though I knew nothing, it was the same, like, super supportive, really encouraging. I raced on a hire bike, was slow, but had lots of fun. And just the atmosphere, I think, made me want to come back. So I'd say, yeah, it's probably a better place in terms of, like, developing the grassroots side of things. But I love indoor track, so yeah, I would go to both.
Yeah, I guess there's, like, as you say, Herne Hill for, like, grassroots is fantastic, and it is, like, put it simply, it's cheaper to be able to race there.
Yeah, definitely.
Lee Valley is probably one of the best facilities in the world, not just the UK, like, internationally. It's an incredible arena, and, like, I mean, for me, as my old, like, when I worked in architecture, that when I was in 2012, when the Olympics was on, I graduated from university in 2012, and I basically went, and my university was involved with some of the, like, Olympic planning and stuff. So we got, like, tickets to loads of stuff as students, which was pretty awesome. But I went to loads of the track Olympic races because I just thought the building was stunning. It looks like a Pringle, but, like, in the best yeah. possible shape way, being a Pringle, like, it's a great Pringle. But yeah, I mean, you can't, like, deny the history of Herne Hill as well, and like the people that have ridden through, or I guess have come through that kind of system, is pretty incredible. Like there's people racing at the top level who used to race at Herne Hill as kids, which is really cool.
Yeah, super cool. I think, yeah, both velodromes have their advantages. And I would say go to both. I wouldn't pick one over the other. Like, it's nice to have the two different experiences.
Yeah, definitely. So why track cycling?
So track cycling, because I used to row. And so I spent about 6 years rowing, and it was quite evident that it was never going to be something I was going to be like really good at. I think I'm more of a power athlete. I was quite good like in the gym when we were doing the weight stuff. And I was coming towards the end of my undergraduate degree in 2016. And decided I didn't want to carry on rowing and was thinking about what I wanted to do next. Mm-hmm. A couple of people suggested track cycling. A couple of people suggested Olympic weightlifting. One other person said athletics. I ruled that out straight away. and then, so it was kind of between track and weightlifting. And as much as I like lifting, I didn't think I could just do that. I kind of wanted to complement it with something else, and so track seems like a good option. And you get a lot of rowers that cross over from rowing to cycling, but I think that's more on the endurance side.
Yeah, you definitely, so my coach used to be a rower who he had a really bad injury, but basically he was on the potential of going to the Olympics at one point, but then had a really bad back injury. But like, it's ridiculous, the crossover of rowing to cycling. And then you look at the E-World Championships that was, Wednesday? I think Tuesday?
Yeah, a couple of days ago. Yeah, I think Wednesday.
The men's race was won by a guy who is predominantly a rower.
Yeah. Right?
and everyone was like, how did you, and I saw in the like post-race interview that he was going, the only reason I think I won is because I know how to suffer. And in rowing, you really suffer.
And, yeah.
And that's where I've also noticed that a lot of rowers become really good time trialists. Really, really strong time trialists, because it's that whole being able to suffer and just bury yourself for, a certain amount of time and then kind of just deal with it.
Yeah, it's, I guess the main rowing race is like shorter distances than you would maybe do in cycling, but half the season is essentially time trialing when you're doing head races. So it's like one boat at a time instead of the side-by-side stuff. So you're used to kind of just focusing on like yourself or your crew instead of what's going on around you. Mm.
Do you miss it?
Sometimes. I'm still involved. I think I just wasn't enjoying it as much when I decided to stop. I think it was like a good reason for me to step away. But I'm still very much involved. I coach rowing at the club where I learned to row all those years ago. So it's a club in East London called The Lee. And then the past 8 years, I've been working at Henley Regatta, although that didn't happen this year because of the pandemic. But yeah, I like to kind of still stay in the loop, and I've done a few races since I officially stopped, but I don't think I'm tempted to like go back to it.
It must be like
as my main sport.
Yeah, I look at it, and I don't really know them very well. I know of a few people who do row, and to me, the training that goes on in the winter does not appeal to me in the slightest. It looks cold and wet and miserable. But
yeah,
I guess it's the same as cycling.
Yeah, but I think the thing about rowing that gets you through the winter is, I mean, it doesn't imply if you're going out in a single by yourself, but if you're going out in a crew boat, then you're in it with other people. So you show up for your teammates, you suffer with your teammates, and that's quite nice. But then you do wonder why you train and race really hard all through the winter and then you have the summer off. It seems kind of weird. Like the last big race is early July and then you have a couple months off and then you start again.
It seems really counterproductive, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, I think for cycling, maybe not so much for track cycling, because the track cycling season, especially indoors, is quite often the winter. But for a lot of the stuff that I do is I pretty much generally take December off, like straight up, because I think it's really important to have that mental reset. And I personally put way too much pressure on myself the rest of the year that I need a season to just like relax, you know, spend Christmas with friends and family. My birthday's in 7 days, so relax on for that, you know, like actually enjoy the month and not really be too focused about anything. But yeah, I guess it's a bit different with track, because track season quite often is the winter a lot of the time.
Yeah, like winter tracking at Deer Valley. I think this is definitely one of the things I struggled with when I switched over to cycling, because I didn't just race. I started off racing track, but then I started racing crits, and then one fixed crit, and then three road races. But I was kind of racing all year and not really knowing when I could take time off, which was a bit of a struggle. But I guess now that I've switched over to sprinting, like my season is kind of May till the end of January, which is when nationals is, and then those few months in between is the break.
So important, isn't it, to have that time to just like decompress. It's like, I know with the sort of stuff I do, my like pet hate question is what's next. I hate it, because it installs like this concern that you've got to keep thinking on what you're doing next, when in reality I think it's really important to like kind of live in the moment that you're in. Obviously plan for the future, but live in the situation you're in and kind of like relish on what you've already achieved over the course of a year. And that's why, like, for me, December's quite a good downtime, because it's the end of the year, so I can like look back and kind of stuff and think about it. But yeah, it's definitely one of those things where I think, especially as you mature more into a sport, you understand the benefits of taking time away from the sport. I think like when you're younger, you're just like doing it all the time, everything all the time, every opportunity. And then as you say, like, you've done some fixed gear crits, a fixed gear crit,
just one a
road racing crits, the track, and then you've kind of sort of found that you've really sort of focusing on the sprinting side, so that's obviously fundamental priority, and the rest of it is more for fun, I guess.
Yeah, fun. So I think this year without the racing was kind of good in the sense, I mean, after nationals I was planning on taking a break from sprinting anyway. I think I was a bit like burnt out from it and I need to do something different. So I raced a couple of crits for fun, and then
how did you do in them?
The first one was really bad. It was an airfield in Abingdon.
Yeah,
and it was so windy and just not good at all. My friends kept telling me, like, you could win. I was like, if I stay in the bunch, which I didn't, then I can sprint at the end. And then the second one was in Brighton, on their weird velodrome there that's like half flat, half banked.
Yeah.
Which I did win. So yeah, that was good. But I would have enjoyed it anyway. But yeah, that was the last race I did before everything stopped in, I think it was early March.
Yeah.
But yeah, this summer I kind of was like found joy in just like riding for the sake of riding and not riding for the sake of training for a race. Mm-hmm. Like I do love training, but I think I was getting caught up in like this session is like, if this session doesn't go well, then it means the race that I'm working towards isn't going to go well. So to just be able to ride and have fun was really nice. And an element I definitely want to keep.
Yeah, it's really that I'm with you on that. Like I find training is good to have the structure. And I like having that structure, but I find that you do lose that social aspect of riding if you're training all the time. And you also lose that, like, the kind of the reason a lot of people get into cycling to start with is because they just like riding their bike and going and exploring. And you can quite quickly lose that if you're so focused on training all the time. So I feel like from a lot of people I've spoken to, there's so many bad things that have obviously come out of this pandemic. And it is a horrible situation to be in that unfortunately globally we've all had to deal with, but there's strengths that have come out of it as well. Like I feel like it's built communities up, it's allowed people to try things a bit different and do things a bit differently, it's allowed like a change in mentality about transport, about where you can work, all that kind of stuff, which are things that to be honest needed to happen, or you know, stuff is just going to keep spiraling way out of control. So like, yeah. There's lots of negatives that come from it, but then trying to think of the positives is things like you say, like being able to go out and just enjoy riding your bike, which is very good for your physical and mental health more than anything. And I think a lot more, especially the first lockdown, there was definitely a huge influx of people cycling. It's very noticeable in London. It was amazing to see. It's really amazing to see. I don't know if it's the same. I don't feel like it's been the same this second lockdown, but it still feels like it's like we had that big burst in 2012 post Olympics and then of people getting into riding, and it feels like it's done that again.
I think it still continued a little bit in the second lockdown. Like definitely I've seen more people, or like seeing the same number of people going out into Hertfordshire. And then Regent's Park is still rammed as ever.
Carnage, isn't it?
Sometimes it's a bit frustrating having to like weave your way in and out, but then at the same time, it's really good to see more people out on bikes.
Hmm. We're very limited in the outdoor space in London at the end of the day, and Regent's Park and Richmond Park are two places where people will inevitably flock to have that outdoor space, which is, I mean, I want to say safer than being on the roads, which it is, but it's still not fantastic. You know, there's definitely the I feel like that whole like rat running thing in both the parks I feel like that's got worse recently. It's because with Richmond, for example, they've closed I think one corner of it to cars. But you're still getting people driving through Kingston and Richmond, like that whole cut through still there is full of cars. And then similarly with Regents, it just seems to be that if you come in the, I can't think what gate it is, Roehampton Gate, and go up towards Camden, that route just seems...
Roehampton Gate is Richmond Park.
Oh yeah, it is, isn't it? Okay, the gate on the south...
I know it's funny.
...point of Regents Park. You know what I mean. The one where the Royal College of Physicians is, that's the one. That gate going up to like Camden just seems to be pretty horrific a lot of the time, doesn't it?
I think that's been okay. I went a few weeks ago and there were temporary lights on that corner.
Ah.
And so then that just
Right off.
It was really not worth riding there. But
yeah.
I think if you find the right time to go, then it's not too bad. I went for a ride like mid-morning, and even though it was crazy getting there in the park, it was super quiet, like cyclists and cars.
Yeah, I found that as well when I've like similar sort of mid-morning, like after the like 9:30, 10 o'clock sort of rush, sort of between 10 and before lunchtime, I've always found it's actually quite nice. And the inner circle is actually amazing, even though it's tiny.
I should probably try it more. I mean, just because it's so tiny, I'm like, oh no, I don't want to go around in circles. But
you do get dizzy.
I do that on the track.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a slightly smaller circle. And I guess it is banked on one side. It's all kind of on a hill.
Yeah. I just have to make sure I'm turning left, and then it will
be
more track-like.
Ah, you'd be fine. It's I think that, so the inner circle, when they resurfaced it, it's now like, before it was resurfaced, it was pretty crap, but now it's been resurfaced. It's just actually really nice to ride. And if you're doing it with like, if you're with a friend or something, because one of the things that I think is really important about riding with people is that whole conversation and being able to just talk. And I think it's really easy when you're on a bike and when you're in the inner circle, because it is quieter than the outer circle. It's actually very easy to talk. And before you know it, you've done 20 laps, 20K. So 1 kilometer a lap. So that's definitely one of the strengths of it. On your own, I've gone there to do like TT training sessions.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty close to where I currently live, and you can actually ride on a TT bike on it. And you get dizzy. You genuinely got dizzy doing it, because you're just going around in circles really, really fast. But yes, it's I don't know. There's all this stuff that's been coming up in London recently with like the cycle lanes, and the one that got ripped up after like 7 weeks was pretty sad to see. And I can't think where it was now. Kensington Way, that one. I don't know if you saw about that. They ripped up the whole cycle lane after 7 weeks. I think it was, they said 300 residents complained about it, and there's 18,000 residents that live there.
Was that High Street Kensington, or is this a different one?
Yeah, the High Street Kensington one. Yeah, it's like, I thought it was, I wouldn't ride that bit of road anyway, but you know, with the kids naming the posts and stuff before they ripped it up, it just sort of showed that it was being used for families getting across town. And that's where it was a real shame, I think. But
yeah, that's quite a direct route from, like, I think South Ken to Hammersmith.
Hmm.
So I can see why that's, and there's like a few, obviously like Hyde Park's at one end, and then you've got a couple of parks on the way, so I can see why that would have been a popular cycle route for families.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Yeah. So one of the things I sort of mentioned to you when we first started chatting that I really wanted to cover was weight training for cyclists, because you've got the experience in that. I am shit at that kind of thing. But it's one of those things that like cyclists talk about doing in the winter, in their downtime. And I reckon 80% of cyclists do nothing about it. And I guess I wanted to like cover like why you think that's so important as something that we should be looking at and including into our routine.
Yeah. So I guess anything that I say on the subject is kind of like my perspective and what I've read and not like anything official. So
yeah, of course.
Please do your own research too. I think because I started lifting before I started cycling, it's always been something that I know and I wanted to continue. And for cyclists, I think because it's a non-load-bearing sport, you're not, like, your bones are not, yeah, being loaded in the way that they would be if you were doing, say, another sport. And so it's good to have something to complement that in terms of weightlifting. Like, you don't need to be, I think lots of people are like, oh, weightlifting, it's going to make me build muscle, but it depends on how you lift. I guess like with cycling, you can do different sessions for like endurance or VO2. And it's the same in lifting, like depending on how many sets and how many reps you do will depend on the adaptations you get from it. Mm-hmm. So I think there are ways to lift without kind of negatively impacting your cycling. So there's that side of it. But then I think also it's just nice to have something different to do. The first lockdown, I started lifting at the beginning and then stopped and then was on my bike like 5 times a week, but and not doing anything else. But I don't think that was sustainable for me. So it's nice to just mix up your training a little bit, learn how to move in a different way. And it's also, cycling aside, it's just good for like functional movements and like helping with strength and mobility as you get older, and still being able to do things like pick up the shopping and put stuff in cupboards. And you laugh, but I'm being absolutely serious.
Yeah.
Because like if you're not doing that through some other form of training, then you're not going to be able to do it. So I think those are kind of the different things. You also might discover that you like it. And it's okay to do something just because you like it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Because I think if you spent your whole year training and you didn't like it, you might not actually progress as much because you need to be able to buy into your training. So if you add in things that you like, then it will probably just motivate you a bit more to get through the other things that you may not like as much.
Mm-mm-mm. Do you think that I agree with you. I definitely think there's this perception with a lot of cyclists that, people are concerned about some cyclists anyway. I think it's maybe changing a bit with, like, if you look at the current riders in the men's and women's scene who are kind of note performing really, really well at the moment. They're quite often not what you would generally class as a standard looking cyclist. Like, off the top of my head, who I think of, like, Wout van Aert, he's hench.
Yeah.
He's really hench. And I mean, part of that comes down for his actual body build up, but also the type of riding he does. And he's very clear. He does a lot of gym work as well. And then Kirsten Beald, for example, she's hench as well. Like, she's a muscle monster. She's someone I'd love to meet because she just seems really lovely. Like, really lovely. But, like, you know, you look at Kirsten Beald, for example, she dominates on the road, dominates on the track, and very clearly does a lot of, you know, core strength work to help build her core and make her stronger, especially for the sprint stuff. But I guess maybe the mentality's changing now, but it definitely was a previous mentality. I mean, if you looked at like the Grand Tours and the mountain stages, which are the stages which everyone talks about, no one really talks about the sprinting stages so much, but you look at the mountain stages, the type of person that wins those stages, physically look at them, they'll be tall and thin. Someone that's a climber is pretty standard. I think Grand Tour winners as well, is generally a very tall and thin people. And you look at that and you think, there's this perception that that's what all cyclists should look like. But in reality, cycling, you can be any size, weight, shape, color, whatever it is, you can be anything and pretty much do whatever you want. There's different parts of it that suit individual people. Like, you can go down the route BMXing, for example. I used to BMX as a kid. It's like, you need to be crazy strong for BMXing. You've got to have crazy, like, fast twitch muscles. You've got to be turning the pedals like nuts to be able to get up the speeds because the actual gear ratios are so small in BMX bikes. Like, and it's really nice to see that's now properly recognized as a real sport over the last couple of years, which is great to see.
I really want to try.
Oh, so fun. It's really fun.
They've opened like a new BMX Park, quite close to where I live, actually. So I need to go test it out at some point.
Well, the BMX tracks in Lee Valley are brilliant.
I was booked on to go last month, and then the session got cancelled. So
you got to get on that. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's proper, like, adrenaline junkie stuff. Like, it's really fun. And, you know, and so that, you know, that's very much one physical trait. And say mountain biking as well. A lot of mountain bikers are stronger frame people because, you know, you've got to leverage so much of the bike to be able to control and push through with it. And that's the nature of that side of the sport. And I think I've I can't think what it's called now, but like the cycling, which is like the acrobatics as well.
Oh, yeah. I think I feel like it's just maybe called indoor cycling, but then it's the, I know the stuff you mean. The stuff
it's amazing.
I could never do. You're like, how? How is this possible?
I struggle to track Stan, let alone the stuff that they can do is insane. Like, there's a lot of skill that goes into that. And that's another thing where very clearly, you know, having a strong core is going to be so important for that kind of thing. Like, I can do that. Or even, what's the other one I've seen? Bicycle polo. You seen that?
Yes, I've seen that.
That looks quite fun.
I feel like that's an accident waiting to happen in my case, but it does look pretty fun.
Did you see that Tim went and did some recently?
Yeah, with Rosie, girlfriend. Yeah.
There's like some, apparently he was saying there's a small like collective of people that are doing it around London now, like it's just quite cool. He did tell me about it, but I can't remember who it was that was running it. I had to try and find that one out because it just looked, like you say, it looks carnage, but kind of like it's something different, isn't it? Something different to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess kind of linking back to the lifting side, like those kind of things require coordination, and you can get that from the weightlifting. And then some people are like, okay, I'll weightlift, but I'm just going to do legs because that's what I use in cycling. But I think it's really important to work on your upper body as well. You don't want to end up in balance and then getting injured as a result. I've been there and done that in rowing. It's not fun when you have to sit out for 2 months and not be able to race. And I actually sat on a watt bike for 2 months back when I didn't like them. But yeah, I think it's really great for kind of injury prevention as well. But then if you lift with the right techniques, I think if you're thinking about starting it, then make sure you are coached through the movements until you get used to them before you start lifting by yourself.
That's really important. That's definitely really important. And that's definitely something which I need to have help with, because there's very much a wrong and a right way to do it, isn't there? And you do things the wrong way and you can obviously cause some quite serious injuries from that. I think I started like paying much more attention to sort of core strength work after, it would have been March or April. It was this year, basically, when I did Atlas Mountains, because so going full cycle, last summer I got hit by a van in Regent's Park in the inner circle. This big reason why I don't go to Regent's Park anymore. It really like threw me off. And it was a van where the cafe is basically turning into park to make a delivery. And he just literally wasn't looking. And there was no time for me to stop effectively. And I did like Looney Tunes style splat like that on the side of the van. Mm-hmm. And bike went under the van. It wasn't fun. But it caused me to have a lot of problems with my back, and 2 weeks later I rode the National 24, which was a stupid idea to ride a time trial bike for 24 hours with a ruined back. I'd slipped a disc basically, and it just wasn't feeling right. And then so I caught after the National 24, that was like probably a month and a half to 2 months of not really being able to ride because I was so broken from it. And then I had Atlas Mountains. And I felt Atlas Mountains was start of this year, February time. And I felt okay. I didn't feel 100%. And then I crashed really badly out there. Bent the frame, cracked the wheel, ruined the bike. Ended up, I wore an Atticus white jersey and navy bibs. It was a dare from Jimmy. It's like a day to wear a white jersey. And I was like, you send me a white jersey, I'll wear a white jersey. Wore a white jersey. And that jersey's now hanging up in their office, covered in blood stains and stuff from the crash.
God.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. Because I said to them afterwards, I was like, do you want this jersey back? And they were like, and Jimmy was like, yeah, it's kind of cool. And I was like, it's covered in dust and sweat and blood stains and it stinks. And he was like, yeah, we'll have it back. So anyway, it's back in their office now. But I crashed, yeah, I crashed quite badly there. And that, it was just bad luck, really. And that, I really struggled. I couldn't, I basically had to pull out the race because I broke the bike quite badly. But also, I got to a point where I couldn't really stand up properly because of my back. So
I love how you mentioned the bike first before yourself. You're like, yeah, I pulled out because of the bike.
Yeah. Standard cycling thinking, isn't it, right? But so I didn't also realize that the bike was broken. Someone else pointed it out to me because I cracked the rim like that way around the rim. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't realized because it was filthy and covered in dust and stuff. And then someone pointed it out to me. And so I was like, oh, has anyone got like a, as other people that pulled out the race, it's like, oh, has anyone got like a spare, anyone who's pulled out, can I just borrow a wheel and I'll give it back to you at the end? So just so I could finish. And then some guy was like, yeah, of course. So he took his wheel out of his bike because he pulled out, went to put it in mine and couldn't get it in because the whole back of the frame was bent. And I was like, well, that says it all. I'm not riding anymore. But I think like after that, I was like, yeah, I really need to make a conscious effort to work on my core purely because it's clearly been weakened from being hit by the van. I would never say I had a weak core, but I definitely could have had a stronger core. And then that incident definitely made it worse. So as soon as I got home from that race, it made a real conscious effort of going, I need to strengthen this because otherwise I'm just going to keep having problems with it, doing anything, going for a walk. So now it's pretty good now. But just want this where I figured out that actually this is something that is very important.
Yeah. Were you doing like standard core exercises like planks and stuff, or were you doing yoga?
Yoga and quite standard core exercises, to be honest with you. Nothing that was like too impressive or might have been hilarious to look at, to be fair, but nothing that was like weight carrying or loading or anything like that. More just using my own body strength to try and strengthen up my back as best I could. And as I say, like now it's okay. Could be worse, could be better.
Yeah. There's so much you can do with just your own body weight as well, and like not just having extra loads. Like there's so much you could do with your body weight that's really useful. So,
there's probably a lot of people that think that weight lifting and building your core strength is focused on actual physical weight. But as you say, we are, as humans, we're quite heavy anyway. And it's just knowing how to use that weight to strengthen certain points, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And like having control over your stabilizing muscles when you're doing other movements. Like I run core circuits with the kids I coach, and it's, yeah, work in progress, but just, okay, I guess kind of little but often is what you need in that respect.
Would you say that the little and often is better than the big and less often?
Yeah, I think it's more about the consistency than the, oh, I'm going to do this like three times, like go really hard and then, yeah, stop. Because then the little and often, you can kind of you may struggle at the beginning, but as you build form, then you can kind of progress that way instead of just, yeah, going ham and then not wanting to do it ever again.
Yeah, it's that point when you just get all the aches and you're like, nah, it's not, this isn't the one. This is, there's got to be something better that you could do as opposed to not actually being able to walk downstairs because you tried to carry ridiculous weights or something. The recent thing I've been doing, as I alluded to with all the pile of stuff behind me, is carrying loads of boxes around. That is something where you need to know how to carry boxes properly, which is such a stupid thing to do. But my God, if you don't bend properly, it gets really, really bad and really painful. I learned a lesson.
Hinge from your hip.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it all, you know, it's all very relatable, isn't it, at the end of the day? So one of the things that I always do, and I did pre-warn you, is ask for 5 tips, hacks, whatever it is. And I don't think I pre-warned you in the sense of saying, I always ask this question, but I don't think I told you the kind of things that have been given in the past. It's been anything from cooking tips to like how to mount, tips to get a tire on your rim on your bike, painting tips. I've had painting tips. I paint, so I was like, yeah, this is quite good. And then there's just been some like really like deep, meaningful ones as well, where I'm just like, you sit there, you're like, yeah, that makes sense in some way. So I'm gonna ask you to hit me with your 5.
Okay. Number one, recovery is key. I guess you kind of wrote on this earlier, but I think the longer I've been in sport, the more I've realized how important it is to recover as well as do the training, because if you don't recover, you can't do the training. So yeah, it's not a nice road to go down if you don't factor in the recovery.
Have you ever got to a point where you've not, where you haven't really listened to your body and things have just got into a bit of a spiral?
Oh yeah, definitely.
That yeah. Sounds like it's a regular thing.
I think it's something I'm getting better at kind of like being more aware of. And I recently started with a coach, I think a couple of months ago, and I was like, my issue is not doing the training, but it's doing too much. So yeah, I need someone to kind of make sure that I recover as well.
Do you think it's really,
it's something I'm aware that I do, I just need to
it's one of those things that I think having a coach really helps with, because I know from my experience I get really bad like FOMO from not riding. And my, for example, I spoke to my coach yesterday and he was just like, in December, he was like, you've had probably the biggest few months that you've ever had on a bike. So bearing in mind the amount of like training stress, like the 107 challenge caused, and then taking a little bit of time off and then training to do a trenching challenge. And he's like, that over the course of like 3 months, that's more than most people do in a year. You need to have some time off. And I was like, okay.
Yeah.
It's being told, isn't it? It's being told that you need
to. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was like, by all means, just go out and have, like, go for a couple of nice rides. And he's like, at all means, there's a couple of, like, structured sessions just to keep you, like, ticking over, but enjoy Christmas.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's really important.
Mm. Yeah. It's one that I think a lot of people, it's one of those ones which is do as I say, not as I do, isn't it?
Yeah. Which is what I said to you when you pre-warned me.
Yeah.
But I think it's a process, and like you keep learning, and yeah, you may not get it right the first time, but you'll know better for next time.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What's number 2?
Number 2, control the controllables. So I guess this was kind of brought to my attention from like a racing perspective, because yes, with sprinting, when you're up against just one other person, you're like, oh, like you think a lot about the other person, or that's what I did anyway. I'm like, oh, they're faster than me, or like, I'm not going to win this because, yeah, whatever. And someone was like, focus on what you can control. So like how you like prepare yourself going into that race, like mentally and physically. But then I think it kind of really hit home in the first lockdown, mm-hmm. when I wasn't able to go into the office anymore and I wasn't able to train in the gym. And then it's like, okay, focus on what I can control, which is set up an office space from home. I can do this training from home and I can set my own routine. And yeah, having that at the back of my mind has been really helpful this year.
Yeah, it's definitely for 2020 has been one of those things, because there's so much that is out of everyone's control. Just to be on top of the things you can do to give yourself structure. I think that's where, as you sort of alluded to, is having that structure is the thing that is really, really important. Routine and structure and keeping on top of that.
Thrive off those things. I like to, have some, some of those in my life.
Nice. Go on, what's number three? This is where it starts to get hard normally.
So number three, write stuff down. So I think kind of coming from two perspectives. One is I keep a training diary. I have done for like the past 10 years. And it's just kind of to like keep track of weights and like rowing scores and then see how it's progressing. So it's nice in that sense to like see how you're progressing. And then I guess with racing, it's been good to write stuff down so I can go back and reflect on it. But then also I always have like lingering thoughts about whether it's racing or stuff to do with my PhD or other stuff in cycling generally, but if I don't get out of my head, it's just going to stay there. So if I write it down, then it kind of takes a bit of that like anxiety, right? What was that?
It's just you saying about writing things down. I'm the same.
Yeah, so my friend got me into like bullet journaling this year, which is like a notebook with like a dotted.
Yeah, that's a nice colour, that.
Yeah, so it's got like dots, so if you can see them, maybe not, but you can kind of customise it. So this is like my new training diary. So I've got like space to kind of keep track of stuff, like my mood and whatever, and then the training and the recovery I did. So I'd make sure I like did some stretching or like had a protein shake, and then like a space at the bottom for like anything else I want to write down.
It's good to be able to have that to look back on, isn't it?
Yeah. I started off with like those academic diaries. But yeah, now it's kind of nice to be able to like set out a page how I want it. And then if I don't like what I've done for 1 month, then I can change it for the next month.
What's your PhD in?
I'm looking at how you can use wearable technology in sports to measure biomechanics.
That's cool.
I'm like sports all around.
That's pretty much. Cool. That's really cool. There's something I'm well fascinated in at the moment as well, just wearable technology anyway, because I think like everyone's been looking at like Apple Watches. You've got a polar watch on, haven't you? Yeah. Like, and smartwatches are like, I mean, it's just got a bit nuts really on how popular they've become. But then it's that, what's the next step in Sensibly after that? That's where it's starting to get really interesting. And like from a, for like my time trialing head, the wearable technology that comes into being able to measure your like CDA and stuff in real motion when you're riding. Because there's one thing about going into wind tunnels and getting wind tunnel data, but it's not, that's in a wind tunnel. It's not the same as actually being out on the road. It's not the same as when you're fatigued. It's not the same as when you're, you know, say you've been riding for like 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, there's I think it's this thing called a Notio that's come out. Okay, it's a Canadian company. Notio. It's owned, they're owned by Argon.
The
Argon 18 bought the company, but it's called, I think it's Notio or Notio. And it's effectively like a sensor that goes on the front of your bike, like mounts underneath your Garmin. And it's kind of wearable technology, kind of isn't, but allows you to like record live data on how your body is performing under stress, recording your CDA, your drag, everything like that. And then there's another one, which I can't, for the name of me, remember the name of, but basically it's all these like little square sensors that you can attach to your body when you're riding or to your shoes. I can't remember the name of it. I'll find it and I'll let you know what it is. I can't remember the name of it, but Adam Hansen.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, Adam Hansen, who was at Lotto, what are they called? Yeah, Lotto Soudal. I think he's retired now, but he was like a big advocate for it. And oh, it's just fascinating. It's really interesting, the wearable technology stuff. There's so much gains that you can get without actually realizing it.
Yeah, and I think it's really important what you said about the difference between testing in a wind tunnel and testing in real life. And I think that's such a big driver for wearable tech, because yeah, if you're in a lab, then you're not like moving in exactly the same way. And in a wind tunnel, you're fixed, but your position, your bike wouldn't be fixed if you're riding on the road. And it's the same in rowing. My supervisor's been involved in like lots of rowing testing, and they do that on an erg in a lab with like motion capture cameras around, but it's nowhere near being the same as actually rowing in a boat on the water, which is really unstable.
Did you know that I was having a conversation with a guy who designs bicycles. It's a pretty cool job. We were talking about how aerodynamic testing is done for bikes and for different bike brands, because every bike brand has a different way of testing their bikes and the aerodynamic drag of it, etc. Some brands, for example, don't test with a mannequin or anything. They just test the bike. Which personally I see that as a flaw, because a bike can't propel itself forward on its own. And they don't test it with a mannequin because it will produce worse data for the bike, basically. Even though the human being is the, you know, we are instinctively the biggest cause of drag on a bike anyway. There's some brands that don't use a mannequin, some brands that only use a mannequin, and some brands who do no mannequin, mannequin, and then real world data. And they're using things like this Notio thing and this other one that I can't remember the damn name of. They're using them to help produce that real world data. So you're getting no human interaction, mannequin in a lab out in the wild. And that's the best data at the end of the day, is getting the out in the wild data at the end of, because it's how a person uses something, isn't it, at the end of the day? Same with running, like running shoes. It's, you know, over different surfaces, you're going to get a different response and feedback from the shoe. I need to remember what this thing's called. It's going to bug me. I've got to find it. I'm going to try and find it really quickly. While I'm trying to find it, what would be tip number four?
Okay, so I thought about this one, and it's like it kind of, it applies to cycling, but also to just real life in general. And that's have an emergency snack.
At all times.
Like, well, so I think sometimes, like cycling, if I know that I'm going like on a long ride, like I'll be put stuff in my pocket, but then I'll put something in my saddlebag as well, like as backup, or like, oh, I'm really hangry and I need the Snickers bar.
Is the Snickers bar the emergency snack of choice?
Yeah.
That's a great shout.
But then I guess also in real life, I've just been stuck in situations where limited access to food and I do get grumpy when I'm hungry. So yeah, having an emergency snack, I think.
Well, have you got an emergency snack right now?
I've got a cup of tea, which I've been drinking. So yeah. I had breakfast like not too long before.
I had breakfast, I think 10 minutes before we spoke, kind of intentionally. And I had yesterday, because I was stressing out yesterday, I had a box of Celebrations.
A whole box. Nice thin.
About that, like a smaller one, is about 3/4.
Okay. Oh, okay. I say that like it's still acceptable. Actually, I do have my advent calendar, so I guess that's my emergency snack. Yeah,
that's one of the benefits of December, isn't it? Advent calendars.
Yeah, although I almost forgot to get one, but I was like, no, I think I need one. I need something.
I forgot to buy one. Me and my partner would always buy one for each other, but with this year, December just seemed to creep up on me and I forgot to buy her one, but she made me one.
Mm.
Yeah. So I felt incredibly guilty, but I managed to find one and got her one a couple of days late. But because I felt really guilty, I also bought her a massive Yankee candle. There's a Christmas one, it's festive, and an assortment of beer because she likes beer. So I felt so bad, especially when I went round to hers, because we have our own places, but we also spend a lot of time together. I went round to hers and she'd made one and it was hanging up in the thing. And I was just like, I literally was like, I was like, I'm really sorry. And she was like, look, it doesn't matter. You've had a lot to deal with the end of November, because like the trenching challenge was the last weekend of November. So, and I was knackered for the first week after, well, the week after that, which wasn't very well. And, but yeah, they are a magical. We should have advent calendars definitely leading up to Easter as well. I think that would be a good time. Why not?
Maybe, yeah. Although
that's a no.
it's kind of the opposite of like giving something up for Lent.
True. Fair point. I, on a side note, the other company that I was trying to find is called Leomo.
Oh, yes. Someone else has mentioned that actually. Yeah.
Leomo. And they do, it's a really interesting like product. I really want to try it out, because how it works is, I don't think you can see that, it's like sensors that you apply to the body, but you can use it for cycling, running, whatever it is. It's just, that was the first photo that kind of showed it quite well. But the idea is that it can, you know, it's giving you real world data while you're riding or whatever it is. The only question I have is, do those sensors become like really annoying when you're riding or running, because you're sticking them all over your body?
This is another thing about wearable tech.
Yeah.
That you don't want it to be obtrusive or affect the movement that's taking place. I did maybe write a review paper about wearable tech, which is why I keep coming out with this stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's really important, because if what you're wearing is affecting the movement, then that's not good.
Yeah, so they
kind of want the wearer to forget about it.
Yeah, you don't want it to be intrusive to whatever you're doing at the end of the day. And then I'd imagine when it's like that, when it's on your shoes, that's not so much of a problem. So that's the actual sensors mounted to your shoes.
Yeah.
But if you were then to, but it's the ones which you stick on your body, I could imagine maybe you wouldn't notice it so much in cycling, but I'd imagine you would really notice it running. It depends where you
sit. I think if it's, yeah, and if they're like super lightweight sensors, but then I guess maybe kind of similar to the aerodynamics, it's a case of like doing the same test with and without the sensors to see if there's an impact through wearing the sensors.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Notio one, N-O-T-I-O, is, this picture shows it quite well. So it's that little prong that sticks out the front.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know how, I honestly don't know how good any of them are, but I'd love to try it out and find out sometime. It'd be fascinating. I think it's just, as you sort of said, like it's creating that extra information and being able to test things in real world, isn't it? Anyway, back on the snacks. I have no snacks here right now. Like similarly to you, I have my breakfast not long before we started speaking on purpose because I knew I'd probably want something and I'll probably eat something afterwards.
That's totally fine.
So we got one more. Go on, what's your last one?
I had something written down, but I feel like maybe, I don't know, maybe I'll, No, I'll go with it. I was like, oh, maybe I'll change it, but I'll go with it. So the last one is, like, keep up the mobility work. Again, this whole little and often thing with, like, whether that's like some stretching or yoga or like, it's not about being like flexible per se, but it's about like being mobile and being able to like move through the range of motion that your body is capable of.
It's definitely, I think it's, as you said, it's one of those things where little and often goes a long way. It really does. I always think about it like I never or very rarely would ever take the lift in my block of flats. I just do the stairs. I live on the fourth floor. It's like, but that's something which is like little and often you just do that and it breaks up. What's the date on the bottom of your mug for?
I went to one of those places where you can paint like pottery. So I painted this mug.
It's really nice.
Thank you. I kind of chose colours that match my tarmac, the camo one.
Yeah.
And then the date is when I painted it. So I think
it's
the
nice.
6th of October last year.
You have got a large assortment of nice specialised bikes, haven't you, as well?
If 3 is large, then yeah.
So, yeah, 3, I mean 3 is more than 2, so yeah, it's pretty large. There's that tarmac from the camo-y one that I've seen.
Yeah.
And then the track one is really cool.
Yeah, that's like even crazier paintwork than the tarmac. It's a bit too hard to describe, so maybe just look at my Instagram if you want to see what it looks like.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe what's going on because there's a lot going on, isn't there?
Right, let me see if I can find it. And then the last one is another tarmac, the SL7 that came out this year, which is a much more tame color.
What color's the new one?
It's like a really, really deep red.
Yeah.
So it almost looks black, but depending on the light, then it's actually red.
What do you, which one do you prefer out of the SL6 and the SL7? You're obviously going to say the SL7.
No, I like them both, but I think I'm more attached to the SL6 for like sentimental reasons, because that's the one I rode for the Tram Red campaign, the ETAP Access campaign. And then I got to keep it afterwards. So yeah, that was really cool. But that's kind of my roller's bike at the moment. And then the SL7 is my outdoor bike.
Roller's bike and outdoor bike?
Yeah.
And the track bike, have you got it at home or is it at the velodrome?
It's at home.
Yeah.
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 Currently hanging on a wall.
Yeah. I mean,
not, yeah.
Specialized.
I'll get to use it next week.
You're going to use it next week?
Yeah, I'm going to the track next week.
Yeah. Nice. They definitely, I think everyone very much has a keen eye on specialized paint jobs because they're pretty out there. They do some great work. It's really, really cool. And I remember that, that camo-y tarmac SL6. It's just like, it was just a really good color, like really nice, really, really nice.
Yeah, really, really nice. Matching shoes, which I'm going to be sad when I have to replace. I don't think they do that color anymore, but yeah.
Get to this point. I'm really funny with cycling shoes that I don't like changing shoes. So, because it's that whole like getting used to them again. I only wear one brand of shoes. I only wear Shimano shoes because they just fit really well for me. But they bring out like a new version, or my current ones. I've got a black set and like these like color iridescent-y ones that are like blue. And then I've got the mountain bike ones, which are like really blue. But I don't like the black set. Are like 3 years old, 4 years old. And I still wear them loads because they're really comfortable. And I had this whole like concern about like putting on a new pair of shoes and having to then get used to them again. In reality, you don't really notice a difference, but I really don't like that.
Yeah, and then I guess also having to like set up cleats for your new shoes and then, but I have, I think, two pairs of the same shoes in different colours and then like another pair. I have to wear specialised shoes. Not that's a problem because I like them. But I have like the Torch 3.0s in like two different colours. And it was like just easier to stick with the same type because I know that I like them and they fit my feet.
Yeah, that's all that matters at the end of the day. Like it's one of those things, hasn't it, been with like cycling where I don't think cycling teams should have a saddle sponsor or a shoe sponsor because it's what works for you at the end of the day, fundamentally. And, you know, you do see quite often, you know, there were a team, I can't think who it was. Katusha used to be sponsored by Citi when they existed. And any rider that wasn't wearing Citi shoes had to wear Citi overshoes that were printed to look like the shoes. And it's just silly, isn't it? Like, there's nothing against Citi shoes at all. They're fantastic shoes, but they don't work for every person. Just, you know, everyone's different. And similarly with saddles, when like, you know, I think it was Physique sponsored a lot of teams for quite a while, but Physique saddles are very personal as well. Like they're much better now. Their range is a lot broader, but it always used to be that they were kind of like the saddles that were provided as stock on a lot of bikes, but a lot of people didn't get on with them.
Yeah.
What Specialized have done is their range of shoes and saddles is incredibly diverse. There's pretty much one for every person out there, really. I used to always ride on a Roman. It was a great saddle, but it was always great, not perfect for me personally. But that's a saddle that I think, I don't know, 70, 80% of cyclists, this is probably one of the most popular saddles, the Specialized Roman. It has been brilliant.
Yeah, that and the Power Expert.
Yeah.
Power Pro, the Power Saddle. Yeah. With the cutout. It's quite nice.
Yeah.
And the shoes. So I have like quite wide feet. And so I've, gone through like a trial and error process with shoes. But luckily, the Specialized ones fit fine.
Yeah. I'm the same. I've got wide feet. And it was just like, I think I tried probably about 6 or 7 brands, and you don't really know until you've ridden in them for like a while.
Yeah.
And then you're like, no, these really don't work. The one that I struggled with the most, and I really like the shoes, but they just didn't work for me, with Bonds. Super stiff, really, really good shoes, but they ruined me, absolutely destroyed me. I really like them. I think they're great shoes. Like aesthetically, they look cool. Like they're really customizable. But yeah, they just absolutely. Maybe they've changed. This is going back quite a few years. I tried them, but yeah, they just couldn't literally could I think I could do about 40k in them, and that was it.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's not good. I think I never tried them, but they're really popular on the like track sprint side. I think quite a few people have them.
Yeah, definitely. Anyway, I could talk rubbish for a long time, and I'm very conscious that I won't. Thank you, Yui, so much for your time on pretty dismal looking Friday morning outside my window anyway.
Yeah, it looks pretty, not nice.
I have no intention of going outside apart from maybe to go and get some lunch. That's pretty much it.
I have to go to work later, so we'll be outside.
Yeah.
Well, to get to work, but not while working.
Yeah.
I'll be inside.
Yeah, nice. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, and I will talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.